The brilliant Christian writer Oz Guinness once wrote this: "There is always a tension between what people say they are and who they really are." And it's always been like this. I'm well aware of it in myself. And in church ministry, I've been working in it for a while. I'm all too aware of it in others as well. It doesn't matter if we're ministry team, church wardens, long-standing members, or total newcomers. I guess the difference is if we've been around longer, then we know better how to mask the reality. We know the right conventions, the right language, even the right facial tics. That's why arriving somewhere new can be so tricky and awkward. I mean, you come in, you don't know the rules. You make cultural gaffes. You have to ask where the loos are and what people are supposed to do with their coats. The result? Well, the newcomer always sticks out a mile. And yet the old hand always knows exactly how to be. And thus the distance for the old hand between the surface mask and the reality underneath can get greater and greater. There is always a tension between what people say they are and who they really are. Now, if Guinness is right, and I'm sure he is, then we must be careful. And our passage illustrates this point beautifully. For Matthew pits together two more different groups of people you could not find. In the red corner, we have the insider's insider, the king, surrounded by his court of religious leaders. In the blue corner, we have the ultimate outsider, a group of Persian magi or astrologers. Now, a magus was perhaps the ancient equivalent of a New Age tarot card reader. Well, that's probably a little unfair. They weren't charlatans, these people. They were highly educated men who knew the night sky so well that they could spot tiny changes and thereby draw all kinds of conclusions about life and the future, as if the world was ordered by the movement of planets and suns. But the reality is they were not the types you'd expect to be part of God's global purposes. They certainly did not know the social conventions for God's people. They were outsiders in every way. But as we'll see, there is always a tension between what people claim to be and what they really are. And the most surprising people can be the very ones who take God seriously. And it's always been like this, which is a warning for the regular. And a great encouragement if this is your very first time in a church. So there are two key things I want to bring out from this passage in Matthew 2. The first is simple. It takes God's king to bring astrologers to worship. It takes God's king to bring astrologers to worship. Now, astrologers, I guess, have always got involved in politics from time immemorial. I don't know whether or not you heard this week about the self-appointed Grand Warlock of Mexico, one Professor Antonio Vazquez. He predicted that in 2012, Obama will lose the US presidential election. Well, who knows? We'll have to wait and see on that one. But I was amused by the BBC website's dry note describing that he's been making New Year predictions for 25 years now, but as it puts it, with decidedly mixed results. So for instance, he said that in 2011, a Latin American leader would be assassinated. Well, thankfully that didn't happen. And that in 2008, Britney Spears would die. Well, that didn't happen either. Well, the truth, as they say, will out. But Matthew is very clear in chapter 2. God is at work, even through astrologers. None of these events could possibly have happened without him. I mean, how else would a motley crew of pagan stargazers travel halfway around the known world just to visit a newborn? Now, I want you just for a moment to forget everything you know from the other Gospels, especially from Luke's Gospel. Put that all to one side. Let's just focus on Matthew. You turn back a page to Matthew chapter 1, and you see that he opens with this long, extended list, a family tree, tracing this baby Jesus' family line all the way back to Abraham, and thus demonstrating his Jewishness, his Jewish credentials. And then look what immediately follows this. It's very strange. The strange tale of Joseph's divorce plans. And then we completely miss out the cowshed, the shepherds, the no room in the inn. We miss out the presentation of the baby Jesus in the temple. We miss all that out. we jump straight to perhaps a few weeks after Jesus was born with these pagan astrologers looking for him. We've gone from the very private and intimate moment with Joseph's God-given dream telling him to stick with Mary. I mean, you know, it must have been a real shock for him to discover that the woman he was engaged to was now pregnant by another man, or so he would have assumed. It's natural to draw all kinds of conclusions. He must have found it difficult. The angel, through the dream, tells him to stick with Mary. A very private and difficult personal moment for him. But we move from that, thrust into the public and political spotlights of Jerusalem. Matthew is making a very important point. In this supposedly most Jewish of Gospels, God is at great pains to demonstrate Jesus' global credentials. And just look in our passage. Look at what it takes to get Magi safely to and from the infant king. Verse 2, a star. Verses 5 and 6, a prophecy. Verse 12, a dream to get them home. A star, a prophecy, a dream to herald a king. God's king. Not just the king of God's people Israel, but the king of the cosmos. Now, historians debate exactly what sort of celestial event is in mind. They confer with astronomers. And well, we know that King Herod, rather, actually died in 4 BC. So Jesus must have been born sometime before 4 BC. And those who understand these things can identify various astronomical events quite accurately. It could have been a comet. Some thought that it was Halley's Comet, but that came apparently in 12 BC, so it can't have been that one. It could have been some great planetary alignment. It could have been a supernova. Who knows? I don't think it matters what it was too much. What does matter is that it got these stargazers to Judea. We're meant to be impressed, even though Matthew almost seems to throw it out as if in passing. Look at verse 2. The Magi come to Jerusalem. They naturally start asking around. Where is the one who's been born king of the Jews, they ask. We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. As if that was the most natural thing in the world. My guess is that they expected everybody to have got there first. As they start inquiring in all the taverns and hostels, they no doubt assumed everybody else must have figured it out before them. It was just a matter of asking where the party was. Perhaps they imagined it would have been a bit like London will be this summer. You know, a tourist comes in July or August and says, you know, asks, where's the Olympics? And everybody in the city, even if they got no interest in the Olympics whatsoever, everyone will know. But this wasn't quite the story when the Magi visited Judea. We'll come back to this in a moment. But bizarrely, the Magi's request in verse 3 caused alarm. King Herod was disturbed, and we're told so was the whole of Jerusalem. But notice what they do next after this. They go back to the Bible to see what these astrologers were on about. And sure enough, there's plenty in the Bible to get them thinking. Above all, they find in the prophet Micah, quoted in verse 6, that there is quite a specific spot for this event. The star might have given the Magi the general clue where to go. It's brought them to the correct region, but the scriptures get them to the right village, Bethlehem, which, fortunately enough, is just a few miles down the road from Jerusalem. So verse 9, after they'd heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. Far from being disturbed, they're thrilled. Everything is coming together. The climax of their epic journey. I mean, what could so easily have been a wild goose chase now proves worth every mile. I mean, just think about what they've done. It was quite an undertaking. They couldn't, you know, for instance, go online to check BBC News updates, find out what the sort of political situation in the region was. They couldn't find convenient hostelries en route. They couldn't get background research on this baby's family. They couldn't do any of that, of course. It was one huge leap of trust, let alone confidence in their own intellectual and astrological abilities. They were trusting that there was a God
at work. And God used that, which is just what Matthew wants us to see. All of this represents a huge convergence of God's purposes, his cosmic plans. And that was one of the things that I love so much about Tony Jordan's four-part nativity that was shown on BBC One about a year ago. He was a surprising choice, perhaps, to be writing something like this. He was a man who was one of the most prolific contributors to EastEnders on BBC One, and he created the show Hustle, amongst other things. A very talented writer, and yet he showed great reverence to the narrative of Jesus' birth when he wrote this four-part series. And one of the things that he brings out so brilliantly is that something massive is going on. So we're taken from the strange intimacy of a cowshed via an astrology school in Persia to glimpsing huge planetary movements in the solar system. And this clip shows the very moment when everything came together, the convergence of God's extraordinary purposes. Well, as one of the Magi says in the clip, some place for a king to be born, but it was not all that God could find. In fact, it was exactly how God wanted it. God has been at work in time and in space and in lives. Over time, through many prophets and precedents. In space, both on Earth and in the cosmos. In individual lives, in carpenters, philosophers, and rulers. The big question, why? Why the stars? Why the prophecies? Why the journeys? Why all the trouble? Why the disturbances, let alone the emotional upheaval? I mean, if God is going to so much trouble, then this has to be big, doesn't it? This has to be earth-shattering. Well, Matthew wants us to see one word behind it all. It comes three times in just these 12 verses. In verse 2, verse 8, and verse 11. Do you see it? It's that little word, worship. But of a baby? Well, yes. Because as Micah said, and Matthew quotes, this baby will grow up to be the ruler of Judah who would shepherd God's people Israel. Israel's king. But what has this got to do with pagan stargazers? Why do these Persian magi travel so far? In fact, what on earth is God doing using astrology in the first place? Well, Jesus is not just Judah's king. He is the world's king. In fact, he is the divine king. But the word Matthew used in his gospel for worship, it comes a few times. It's actually ambiguous. It can simply mean pay homage. So, for example, when a foreign ambassador comes to Britain, comes to London, each one has to present his or her credentials to the court of St. James, as it's told, which is just a fancy traditional way of describing they've got to come and meet the Queen. They pay her homage. I suppose in the old days, they might even have been said to have worshipped her, because that simply means giving her due worth, what she is worth. Well, whatever happens, of course, no dignitary would use that word, would go to arrive at Buckingham Palace with the expectation of meeting a god. Far from it. That's not worship in that sense. Well, the word is ambiguous. And who knows exactly what these shepherds or the magi in Matthew 2 all thought as they encountered Jesus for the first time. My guess is a sort of jumble of confusions, hopes, and convictions. But certainly it's the case that Matthew wants us to see the word worship develop into something much more than just paying homage. Just a few pages later, the word is used by Satan when he's tempting Jesus in the desert. He calls on Jesus to bow down and worship him, which is, of course, something Jesus categorically refuses. And then when the disciples meet the risen Jesus in Matthew 28, we're told more than once that they bowed down and worshipped him. They clearly see he's more than human. Not less, but definitely more. He is God among us. Emmanuel, which means God with us. To whom worship is the only response. And this is more than just paying homage. This is the worship due our God. But don't you think it's amazing that these ancient hippie stargazers are in fact the very first people in the entire New Testament to worship Jesus. They don't need a witness to witness his life of teaching and miracles and his resurrection in order to recognize him. They just need the stars. Now, the Bible is clear that astrology is wrong. And that is a lesson that many need to hear today, not just in this country, but I guess all over, in many parts, for instance, of Asia. You know, whole lives can be shaped around what the stars do or don't say. Some people take it far more seriously than simply just browsing through your horoscope in the paper each morning. Now, the Bible's point is powerful, though, you see. Why listen out for the inanimate and unclear voice of the planets when we have the creator of those planets volunteering to speak, taking the initiative to speak? And you see, his greatest speech of all is that of a little baby boy born to reveal him, the Word of God. Now, if we're Christian, we have no reasons whatsoever for listening to other more occult voices. There is no need to consult the stars when we know the star maker. But what about before someone comes to know Christ? What then? Before they have seen and heard of his great news? What if their whole lives revolve around the stars? Well, doesn't it just demonstrate the amazing wideness and generosity in God's grace? If it takes astrology to bring somebody to worship this king, then that's just what God will use. In fact, God moves heaven and earth for his king. It's just this sort of love and grace that motivates him to send the cosmic king to the cross in the first place. It would have shocked religious Israelite types, though. They knew their Bibles. They knew what happened, for instance, when King Saul visited a witch. They knew what Moses said about consulting spiritists and mediums. They knew that the God of the covenant revealed himself in words that people could understand, and that's why going after other sources of revelation was unnecessary. And they knew that the God of the cosmos was the God of Israel. Their mistake was to forget that he was the God of everybody else as well. And the actions of these magi exposes the hearts of all religious people. Their appearances may have been pretty alarming. They certainly would have looked out of place, but their hearts were absolutely in the right place, bowing before God's king. That's why they gave their gifts, gold, incense, and myrrh. Now, incidentally, Matthew says nothing of the symbolism that tradition has given these gifts. In fact, all three gifts probably mean pretty much the same thing, the most precious gifts you can find, fit for a beloved king. All three have those sorts of connotations in the Old Testament. And it's more or less what happened, if you think about it, during the greatest Old Testament precedent for this event. Just think, there was another son of David who was on the throne then, and a foreign monarch visits him in Jerusalem and is so impressed that, amongst other things, she gives him much gold. Of course, I'm talking about the Queen of Sheba's visit to Solomon. And now Eastern Magi do it for great David's greatest son, Jesus. This child, this baby, would give his all. The Magi have given their all in return, and they are thrilled to do so. Now, as verse 10 says, they were overjoyed, and so should we be. God has moved heaven and earth for us to acknowledge his king, which makes the response of those in Jerusalem so bitter. So I want to close with a very brief point that simply tees up what we're going to do next week as we look at the second half of Matthew 2. The second point then is it takes God's king not to bring astrologers to worship, but also to expose prejudices in God's people. I mean, it's obvious in chapter 2 of Matthew that there is a vast tension between what Herod is like on the surface and what he's really like in himself. On the surface, he's on the throne, David occupied in Jerusalem. He probably goes through all the right emotions, goes to the temple at the right times, says and does the right things. But He's not, of course, descended from David. He's not even truly Jewish. He's, in fact, kept in power by Roman imperial might. So all the more reason for him to assert his authority as the king of Israel. And to be fair, to begin with, it looks okay. What he does when the Magi announce a threat to his position, he gathers the religious boffins and they consult the scriptures. It's a pretty sensible thing to do if you lead God's people. In fact, that's exactly what the covenant says God's king should do. But his heart is far from God. His motives are twisted. He's far more concerned with his own position and prestige. That's perhaps understandable. After all, it can't be easy for an insecure king to discover somebody else with far better credentials and claims to the throne. But then, you see, if God is at work in time and space, if he is moving heaven and earth to announce his king, well, whoever you are, there's little for it except to get with the program. But something deeper is going on here, and it'll get increasingly spelled out as Matthew unfolds his story, because this newborn king is a threat to all those who like their religion on their own terms rather than God's. Those who like things kept in the family will never appreciate those who are different, outsiders, a bit strange, those sorts who are not like us, pitching up and spoiling the party. But this is early days in Matthew. We've got to wait till next week's passage to see what Herod actually does about this news. But for now, we're just going to leave him feeling rattled. Where does Jesus leave us? Rattled or thrilled? Disturbed or overjoyed? There's no sentimental cooing over newborn babies here. From the word go, this baby divides. But it takes guts to realize that the people you must identify with here are the outsider hippies rather than the insider dignitaries. And yet that's exactly what God wants us to do. God has moved heaven and earth to make this happen. I mean, just stop for a moment, just to drink this all in. God has been at work for centuries preparing for this moment, dropping hints here and setting precedents there. God has been at work across solar systems to get the alignments just right over a tiny, insignificant territory of a tiny planet in a minute galactic backwater. God has been prepared to use unconventional scholarship and potentially misunderstood methods to bring people to visit his king. He's prepared to step outside the religious box and allow his king to attract whiffs of scandal, of scorn, racism, political insurrection, and in the end, even execution. And yet, it's thrilling. Behold your God, my friends. There is a wideness in God's grace and a wonder at God's power. This is Jesus, King of the cosmos, God amongst us. Come and worship your King.